Got three predictions. One is that in the next 10 years, the dairy industry as we know it today, where cows produce milk, will be gone. It will be plant-based alternative milks, or milks made by precision fermentation. The second prediction is that also within 10 years, the meat industry will be half either plant-based foods or foods derived from what's called cellular agriculture. And the third is that within 10 years again, half of the world's fish will be produced in factories. We already have the products. All we need is the scale, the money, and the will.
Hi there. I've got some great guests coming up in the pipeline. So do please subscribe so you don't miss out. Now back to the show. Hi there and welcome to Plant CEO. In today's episode, I'd like to welcome back returning guest, Jim Mellon, the chairman of Burnbrae Group. Hey, Jim, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Anton. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Where are you today?
I'm in Brussels, in Belgium, in my house here. I don't very often get to come here, but I just wanted to come and we're doing some repair work. So I had to kind of check it out.
Every time I call you, we're either at one of your properties, either selling something or doing some repair job or something. What's going on?
Well, I haven't sold any properties, actually, but there's always something that needs to be repaired.
Yeah.
And as you know, I'm not saying that the UK is a bastion of brilliance, but it's quite hard to get reliable workers in somewhere like Brussels, and especially hard to get reliable workers in Spain, where we live a lot of the time. So,
true.
You know, a non-stop battle, basically.
Yeah, 100%. I think last time we spoke, you were in Berlin selling your flat.
Yeah, well, I wasn't selling my flat. I was having meetings there, but I'm trying to sell my flat there. There are no takers. German property is really weak at the moment. And this particular flat is quite large. And whereas in London, you know, the price tag on this flat would not attract undue attention. In Berlin, it's an expensive proposition, basically.
Yeah. So great to have you back on the show. I just wanted to start with last time we spoke, you had 5 Podenco dogs. Apparently, you now have 2 more.
The latest news, and this is hot off the press, never been heard anywhere else before, is that we now have 8.
Wow.
And,
okay.
I think you were correct that there were 5 Podencos and 1 Border Terrier. Now there are 7 Podencos and 1 Border Terrier. And then we also support this shelter, which is in Ibiza, where there are another approximately 30 dogs, most of whom are Podencos. I mean, it's absolutely tragic. And we do whatever we can. And, you know, when you get these dogs, which I have to say the local hunters and huntresses regard as just being disposable, when you get them home, they all have individual characters, they all brighten up, they all love their lives, and we're very, very happy to be able to do that for them.
Yeah, that's amazing that you're doing that. And also, just thank you so much for sending me Juno's Ark. Actually arrived literally half an hour ago, so we just made it for this interview. Can you tell me if Juno is actually one of the names of your dogs?
It is.
Okay.
She is the pack leader. And her mother, although in the book it's described as her sister, is Juniper. And Jingles, which is another one of the dogs that features in the book, is a real dog as well. And Juno's second adventure book, I'm actually going to finish it either today or tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
It will be out in September because the wheels of publishing grind very slow, as I'm sure you know. And that is called Juno Goes to London. And I promise I will send you a copy of that so you'll have both on
awesome.
Your show. And what they said, I mean, I don't know anything about children's books, so I didn't know anything about children's books, is that you need to have a series before it gets a lot of traction, because the children, they finish one and then they want to hear the next story. So you've got to keep producing them, yeah.
So what's your intention sort of long-term with the book?
Well, I mean, these are designed to create, not to be propagandist, but to create an impression for younger children of change in the world. And in the Juno's Ark, it's about changing, which is dear to your heart, changing the current food system. And in Juno Goes to London, it's about mitigating climate change, which he becomes, believe it or not, a passionate believer in, and has some things to say about it. And so I don't want to give away the story of Juno going to London, but I really enjoyed writing it. And there's a lot of truth in, obviously in the climate message and the food message, but in the antics of Juno, because, you know, she has just recently been to London, and her mother, Juniper, although described as her sister, has been having medical treatment in the UK. So it's, you know, there's a lot drawn from real life.
That's awesome. And have you taken it to any primary schools to do some talks about the book? Is that something that, if not, would you like to do it?
I actually don't have the time to do that. So we launched the book at the Oxford Literary Festival. This is the one you've got there, Juno's Ark. And we had a very good turnout, and it was well received, and it sold pretty well, actually. And all the money, not just the profits, but all the money goes to Compassion and World Farming and to the dog shelter that we support in Spain. And, you know, that's the way I'm kind of promoting it. But I am going to hire a very experienced social media agency for this next one, because I think that the medium which you get this out there is, of course, TikTok. And I don't know if I told you on the last lovely interview that you did with me, but I've been on TikTok before, and I think it was 5 million views, which is quite a lot for TikTok.
Amazing. You know,
about cellular agriculture. And the only reason there were so many is that it's so controversial. So a lot of people were sort of saying that, you know, I needed to burn in the fires of hell for, you know, trying to change the world order and God's will and blah, blah, blah. And, but others were coming to support. So if you have, I've been told that if you have something that's a little bit controversial, you get a lot more traction on TikTok. So watch this space. And, you know, when it gets closer to launch, I will be reaching out to you to see if you can help, because it's all in a good cause. And we, I know you do fantastic work getting this message out, but we collectively need to do a lot more in getting our messages out there.
100%. And I'm totally with you on the topic of climate change. I just did another interview that I released about AI ethics, and we spoke about the models currently don't always explain very well what an individual can do from their own standpoint to reduce their own carbon emissions. And actually the biggest thing a person can do is eat a plant-based diet. That's number one. And then obviously things like cut down on air travel, drive electric cars, all that sort of stuff. But the number one thing is eating plant-based food. So let's now move on to food and agronomics. Since last time we spoke, I'm really interested to know about one company that you've created, which is Liberation Labs. So you're building out this precision fermentation contract facility in Indiana. It has scale of producing 600,000 liters of milk, which is, you know, obviously without animal farming. Just a question on the 600,000. Is that what it will produce in a year, or is that like the maximum scale? Just give me an idea of what that means, that 600,000 liters.
Oh, that's a great question. So it's 600,000 per cycle. So it depends on the product. It's a contract manufacturing operation that may produce milk powders, or it might produce dairy powders, or it might produce, you know, anything that can be made with precision fermentation. But it's doing it on behalf of other companies. And so let's say the cycle's 2 days. So okay, it's not 600,000 liters of milk. It's 600,000 liters of granular product to which water would be added to create milk, bioidentical milk. Okay. So it's a lot.
That's a lot then,
still,
yeah.
Would make a very, very small dent in the overall picture.
Yeah.
So this is a plant, as you rightly point out, in Indiana, where there's relatively cheap land costs, cheap labor, and lots of sugar. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that these products are made with sugar and therefore everyone's going to get fat. That's the feedstock, the principal feedstock.
The growth medium.
Exactly.
Right.
And so it'll be up and running by the end of this year, and it's costing $115 million. But it has capacity, and you're absolutely right to identify the 600,000 liters, but the capacity of the whole site is 4.9 million liters, which will make a dent. But obviously that takes a lot more capital investment and equipment. So the first project, and we're very much hoping that the whole of the production for 5 years will be sold forward at the time the plant starts.
Okay, amazing.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, you're going to need something like 1,000 of these plants in the United States.
Exactly, yeah. So you know, you're basically leading onto my next question, so you're already answering them. So it's fine, it's great.
We think alike.
Yeah, exactly. So, what I was thinking also, like just scaling that up. So, it's great if you're thinking about creating multiple of these factories because the USDA, maybe some old figures, but roughly about 17 billion gallons of milk are consumed, which is about 64 billion roughly in liters annually in the US. So, it's a huge amount that we need to scale up as an industry. And I'm glad that you're going step by step because I think there has been some, especially in the media, some criticisms, especially around cultivated meat, creating these facilities and buying all these expensive equipment that just can't scale yet. I wanted to get your viewpoint on that as well.
Okay, well, that's another good question. So basically, as you know, the cultivation of meat on fish is very different to the use of precision fermentation to produce dairy products, lactoferrin, as an example, or to produce egg products, which is the ones that we're focusing on at the moment. And there is no consumer pushback on those. So the dairy products that are currently being produced by the Every Company, Perfect Day, etc., are all sold, right? So immediately sold. They just can't produce them. Hence the need to build the contract manufacturing facilities to service these companies. They are, I wouldn't call them disguised products because they're not disguised, it's fully transparent, but they're bioidentical to milk and egg products. And they go into foods or they go into your coffee or they, you don't, it's not something that you look at with a sort of jaundiced eye as people might with cellular meat. On the subject of cellular meat, there's been a couple of negative articles. We're all familiar with those. About two companies in particular, neither of which we've invested in. One is, I think, a very well-meaning, good company with a fantastic guy in charge, but the valuation he was selling shares at was just too high for us. And the other, and his product's been approved, by the way, and the other is good, good meat, Eat Just, or whatever you want to call it. What, they change their name every day. And that's run by a very promotional sort of person. And without necessarily the backing of the, I mean, I'll be careful what I say here, but without necessarily the full backing of the technology that's required to make it commercially successful. He's had his product approved as well. I mean, there's a vast array of companies that are going to have their products approved in the near future. So the whole point about something like agronomics is to curate the best management, best commercial opportunities, best companies that are executing on their business plan. And the criticism by the various people who are criticizing are either from established industry players or supported by established industry players, or just because they want to create a name for themselves and make fun of a nascent industry. I think it's very similar to when the motor vehicle came out in the early 1900s and the horse and cart manufacturers were doing it down and saying it would never take off, it was dangerous, and blah, blah, blah. And so we've got a similar Luddite attitude. However, as far as I can see now, you're really beginning to get scale and traction. And the problem is there isn't enough money to fund these companies. So the most innovative companies are the ones who are repurposing equipment. So they're taking, let's say, an old brewery and repurposing it for precision fermentation, or buying stainless steel tanks for cellular agriculture on the secondhand market rather than having something bespoke. Because you don't need everything to be new. And stainless steel, as we know, we've got stainless steel kitchens. They last forever if they're properly looked after. You don't need to go and buy brand new stuff. And so we're looking for capital efficiency, nimble management, and so forth. But there's going to be more and more of this criticism. And some of it will stem from the established meat lobby in fish, where we hope to have our product on the market by the end of this year through BlueNalu. There doesn't seem to be resistance. There doesn't seem to be an effective lobby. And indeed, some of the companies that are big in fish, like Union from Thailand, are investors in BlueNalu. And so I would imagine that that's going to have a fairly straightforward run to market. And again, that product will be sold out in full, all its production from day one of the factory being open. So it's, this is like any startup business. It's like a bit like Elon Musk trying to, I'm not saying that we're Elon Musk or any of our companies are like Elon Musk, but he really had to sleep on the floor of his factory. He had to cajole suppliers, cajole governments, cajole everyone to make Tesla the force that it is today. Even today, it might be a slightly diminished force. And so it's all about which management we can identify that's going to deliver the goods. And we think we've identified a few, including Liberation Labs, which I'm very excited about and could be a real world beater.
Yeah, just want to pick up on one of the things that you said about the investment, not getting enough investment. Do you think there's potential to tap into effectively climate money, climate funds, to pay for cultivated meat or more on precision fermentation, for example, instead of the traditional route, which is more of the alternative protein funds, etc.?
Yeah, that's another a good point. We've obviously been trying to get those climate funds to take an interest in what we're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be quite honest with you. If you look at agronomics, the asset value is something like £165 million. It's trebled since it was launched, which is only 4 years ago. But, you know, the share price is at a discount of 40% or nearly 40% to its asset value. So it's impossible for us to raise money, new money for agronomics at the moment. But I said to my colleagues that, you know, if the industry grows and we grow at 30% a year for each of the next 10 years, it doesn't really matter. And if you gear it up, then you've got really juicy returns for infrastructure players who are used to about 10% returns. Mm. And you could get quite a lot of money coming in. And there's a lot of infrastructure funds out there. So we want to be part of that, the funding of the infrastructure. But there'll be plenty of other people who will do it as well. And there's the other thing, lastly, I'm sorry to bang on a bit, is that if carbon credit markets can be properly developed, and they're not there yet, as you well know, then these type of companies should be beneficiaries of carbon credits, and the traditional food companies will be paying basically to buy carbon credits to offset their polluting ways. And so it's a bit of a scrap at the moment. It's a bit scrappy. But I can tell you that of the agronomics companies, 9 of them are in fundraising mode at the moment. I think all of them are going to accomplish their fundraise, which is great in the current venture capital environment. And some of the companies are making massive strides forwards, both in reducing the cost of their product. I'll highlight Good Dog Food / Meatly in that respect, which has got its cost of media down to remarkably, and which has a product now. And my dogs ate it the other day in London, or 3 of the dogs did, and they will be on the market, I hope, this year. And I'm not saying huge quantity, but reasonable quantity. And all the big players are interested in investing in them, partnering with them, doing something with them, because this is the way of the future, right?
100%. Yeah, I definitely believe in the dog food market as well. Like, obviously, from a cultivated point of view as well, right? Or hybrid, you know, mixing the two
exactly.
Between plant-based, because that's going to make it also scalable. You did do some ones that you were thinking of last time we chatted. So you managed to get into Geltor, for example.
Yeah.
Just wanted to touch on collagen. Have you been taking that yourself as a supplement to help with joint pains? Because I'm hearing a lot of people who are, you know, taking that as a supplement, for example. Is that something that you do?
No, it's not, because I don't think it's a good or a bad idea. I think it's because Geltor's not yet selling those supplements. It's in the cosmetics business at the moment. But I have to say, I was very impressed by their sales run rate, Geltor. It's exploding, actually. And we're only a small investor, a few million dollars in Geltor. But there are other companies where we've started the company, or we've kind of got in at a very early stage, which are super exciting. I don't know if you've come across Clean Food Group.
Yeah, so that's the next one, because I was really super fascinated. I didn't know that you'll be able to get a company that will basically create palm oil. So yeah, where did this one come from? That's a bit out of the blue for me.
Right, so this is from the University of Bath.
Nice.
And we went down to visit them just 2 or 3 weeks ago. They are moving out of the University of Bath to a facility nearby. But, you know, I was talking about you know, using repurposed breweries or whatever. That's what they're doing to produce their product. They're not going after generic palm oil, but they, like with Blue Nalu and extremely expensive cuts of tuna fish, they're going after the most expensive fractionations of palm oil. And they've got all the big guys interested in them. They've got joint ventures and research with some of the very biggest food companies in the world. I would recommend, if you've got the time, to go down and see them in Bath. I'm sure they'd be delighted to have you on the show,
yeah.
Because or maybe you'd be delighted to have them on the show. Sorry, I meant it the other way around. But they are delighted to show you around. And
yeah.
They have a very impressive facility team, and they are getting quite substantial capital in, and it's a British success story. And
100%, yeah.
yeah, so I, and you know, the palm oil is highly destructive. It's destructive in the environment, kills orangutans, as you know, and it also is really bad for your health. So what they've done is engineer the product. It's not GMO, but they've engineered it so that it's not the bad sort of fat, it's the good sort of fat that you know, for you to cook in. So it's fabulous, really.
And if you look at like other companies that have done something similar, like Millibio, for example, that created its version of beeless honey, they've been doing fantastically well as well, as an ingredient source.
Yeah, I mean, we've got California Cultured, which is, I think, has just recently funded, and that's doing cocoa. And one of the big, I think it's Mondelez or Hershey, is incorporating its ingredients, its cocoa ingredients, flavanols, into its products. And I don't know if you've seen what's happened to the cocoa market, but it's gone ballistic. It's really up so much because countries can't produce it with climate change, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a massive market, and they're producing cocoa in California in a lab. It's so great. It's fantastic.
It's amazing. Let's move on to
Longevity. Did I
Right.
tell you? I don't think I've told you this, but my grandfather lived to 104 on a veggie diet, which is quite amazing.
That is amazing. Well, it's fantastic. And I'm sure you'll be way above that.
Well, I hope so.
And the veggie diet does no harm and probably does you a lot of good. So, you know, as long as you have the adequate supplementation of, well, you know all about that, of
Yeah, the
folates and
B12, for example. Which we're
So,
all deficient in, by the way, even meat eaters, because of the way, food is processed these days, and you don't get enough soil in your veg, for example, when it's been thoroughly cleaned, for example. So you don't get the B12 from the ground.
yeah, I'm sure that's true. So, yeah, on the longevity side, I'm the second largest investor, deputy chairman of a company called Juvenescence, which is a British-based company, and they've got some very exciting stuff going on. They've got one drug which is looks like it's very promising for warding off Alzheimer's if you take it when you're relatively young.
So let's talk about that. So amyloid, which is this protein that basically, comes together and it causes blockages in your brain vessels. I saw some doctors speaking about if you have curcumin, they did a test where you could look in somebody's eyes and you could see the curcumin sort of binding to the amyloid. So it basically reduces your chance of getting Alzheimer's, because it doesn't cause those blockages in your brain. And obviously turmeric's been around for centuries, but it's definitely an anti-inflammatory, but they've now realized that it can also reduce Alzheimer's. So yeah, I'll be interested to know what Juvenescence is doing around Alzheimer's, as you were going to say.
I think turmeric is a very good idea, but the sad fact is that some people are predisposed to getting Alzheimer's or dementia, and over 85, about half of us will have some form of dementia, mostly Alzheimer's. Now, what's very evident is that people who have very low levels of plasmalogen, which is a cell binding agent, a protein that's in every one of our cells, but particularly prevalent in neural cells, neuronal cells. If you have a very low level of that and you have a predisposition to Alzheimer's, you're almost certain to get it. So if I said the figures are for the general population, forget about the APOE4 variant population, but if I said that about 60% of people with low levels of plasmalogen get Alzheimer's, and only 5% of people with high levels of plasmalogen get Alzheimer's, that's the rough figures. So we have got a product which is preclinical, we're going to the clinic quite soon, which demonstrably replaces plasmalogen levels. And the best time to be taking this is in your 30s, 40s as a daily supplement to stop you from getting it. And if you do get it, it has the absolute capacity, we think anyway, of stopping it in its tracks. So you don't get the tau protein tangles and the amyloid plaque buildup, and you avoid getting Alzheimer's. And this is coupled with new tests that can predict whether you're likely to get Alzheimer's or not, which, you know, in the past, if someone said to me, oh, you're going to get Alzheimer's based on your test, so there's nothing for it. So you're just carrying this burden around with you, but there's no solution. Now there might be a solution. And then the last thing that I think is really interesting at Juvenescence is this PAI-1 inhibition. So, do you know the Amish population? Yeah. So they have their sort of tall hats and, you know, they live in the 19th century basically. And no TVs, no cars, no, they live in their own circle in America. And some of them have what's called a PI1 inhibiting gene. And so PI1 is a gene that basically accelerates aging. Mm. And those people in the Amish population, which is about 10% of them, who have this gene, live 10 years longer than the rest of them.
Wow.
So PI1 is something that drug companies have been looking at for a long time. We think we've got a really effective PI1 inhibitor. We're going to use it for fibrosis, which is a big, big cause of death, inflammation, et cetera, et cetera. And that's filed an IND, as I understand it, and we'll go into the clinic this first half of this year. So, you know, from just talk to actually doing things, Juvenescence is moving forward fairly rapidly. It's got a fantastic new CEO called Richard Marshall, and he comes from Astra. He was a very senior man at Astra, and I think he's making a big difference in focusing the company on the products that are needed both to help patients and also to produce a profit for the shareholders.
Mm, yeah, I'm glad the momentum's really getting faster there for them. And yeah, it'll be great to get rid of these diseases, right? We don't need it in this day and age. You recently spoke with Brian Johnson from his Blueprint. Did you manage to convince him to attend your longevity forum that you've got later this year?
Well, he said he would. I mean, I interviewed him for the longevity forum, but he was in his house in, I think it's in California, I'm not sure, maybe Texas. And he was actually charming. He was really nice. And you can watch it on YouTube if you want to. He is a guinea pig for all of us, because what he does to himself, I don't think any of us would want to do, which is basically starve yourself, have a disciplined regime which never deviates, transfuse your son's blood into yourself and then your blood into your dad. It's, you know, I thought this is all very wacky, but actually he's doing it for humanity. And he also has this olive oil that he's
producing, and a number of supplements as well, longevity and mix and that sort of stuff. Yeah.
I asked him because he's a businessman, right? So this was designed to make him money. And he said, no, this was just to popularize the products he thought were good for people out there. So, you know, but I'm hoping, I mean, we've now got a date for the Longevity Forum for this year, and I hope you can come to it, actually.
What's the date? Tell me later.
Yeah. It's not that I'm trying to hold it back from you. It's I just can't remember. I think it's November the 11th or 12th.
Okay.
That's the one in London. And he said he would come to it. So I don't want to get in touch with him in March about something in November, because you never know what's going to happen. But it would be great to have him in person.
Yeah, 100%.
We'll see if he comes. But there'll be plenty of good speakers anyway.
For sure. I'll definitely take you up on that.
And remember, it's all free for anyone who wants to apply for tickets, all free.
Okay, awesome. The other big passion project of yours is nuclear fusion. I was thinking about this. I'm very much for this as well, as obviously a clean energy. I also worry about one thing, and I wanted to run it past you. When you get nuclear fusion coming into, say, developing nations, i.e. say some parts of Africa where they haven't had a consistent power supply, that's also prevented animal farming industries come into that because of the consistent power supply. But once we have this nuclear fusion energy and you don't have this constraint of where the power will drop, for example, will that start to increase animal farming in those regions that in places where it hasn't been spoiled, and you know, in terms of environment, water pollution, all that sort of stuff? I know it's quite ahead in its time, but what do you think about that? And is there something that we should be doing more to try and prevent the usage of that technology to some degrees in other industries that are polluting for the environment?
Well, it's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. So, I mean, my general view is that it's going to be another 10 years before we get the first commercial nuclear fusion reactor, possibly in the UK. And it will be decades thereafter that the developing world will, there'll be a sufficient scale for the developing world to have its own nuclear fusion reactors. The great news about nuclear fusion is it's not dangerous, right? So, and it can't be used for war. So whereas, you know, Iran has been using supposedly its nuclear program to produce nuclear bombs, or to get to the point where it can produce nuclear bombs, this is not possible with fusion. It can't be used for bad things. So, but, you know, one of the big problems in Africa, and I see it as a big, big problem in the future, is the lack of water supply. You're obviously a big advocate of plant-based foods, and I think that's fantastic, and I completely agree with it. If they had more water, would they produce more plants rather than animals? And maybe in 20, 30 years' time, the answer would be yes, because they could get more water using this unlimited energy source to desalinate, and desalinated water could be the solution to grow abundant plant crops in Africa, which would be fantastic, rather than, you know, intensive farming of animals. But we just don't know. But it's an interesting point that you bring up. I don't think it's something that we should concern ourselves with too much at the moment, because we've just got to get the first nuclear fusion reactors up and running in this country, or in America, but preferably this country, as quickly as we can.
Yeah. Did you go through the same process as when you did Moose Law about interviewing startup companies in this area and then writing your book? And when's it due to be released?
I was probably over-optimistic on how quickly I could do this. It's technically very complicated for me to understand. The whole idea of my books is to take something that's complex and to reduce it to something that I can understand and the layman can understand as well. And so I have started doing some interviews, but I'm nowhere near through that process. And actually, I think that's the best thing, because I want to make it not just about nuclear fusion, but also about nuclear energy generally, because fusion is some way off, but nuclear energy, we could be building the small modular reactors right, very safe, and create a baseload for the grid that unfortunately renewable energy, like wind and solar, can't produce at the moment because there's no adequate storage for the energy that they produce at their peak periods. And so I'm going to make it about nuclear energy generally, and particularly the new types of nuclear conventional fission reactors that are out there now. So we in the UK foolishly got the French to build, to botch up a couple of large power stations. I mean, they couldn't even build their own ones properly, and they couldn't build it in Finland. They couldn't build it elsewhere in the world. And yet we signed up to their technology, and they're way behind time and way behind budget. But Korea Electric Power Company, KEPCO, has got a model that would work perfectly, and we could have 10 of them up within 10 years in this country that would provide, you know, 20, 30% of all our electrical needs. And my question I'm asking is, why don't we just do it? Because I think you know, the French model just doesn't work. I mean, we obviously have to finish those plants. Luckily, the government, for a change, made a good decision and put the burden on effectively the French government to pay the overruns and the additional costs of building it, even though they're cavilling and they want to get some sort of burden share. But if you sign a contract, you sign a contract, simple as that. And but we could do the deal with the Koreans very, very quickly and have these things up running rapidly and change the energy supply.
Yeah, there's definitely a few companies Bill Gates has also invested in heavily in terms of also that model that you were talking about, the smaller nuclear fission scalable models. So it's an interesting space to be in. The other interesting space to get your thoughts on is this AI commercialization race, I like to call it. Obviously, you've got a new breed of companies that are coming out with large language models that are really taking it by storm. And there's companies that have also invested in that. And then you've also got the incumbent companies in the AI space, Google, for example, who have released certain things recently, maybe slightly rushed to market, but and also people being critical about the stage that they're at. Even though I know they've got huge amount of tech invested in this space and they could easily come back. What's your thoughts on sort of the older technologies versus the new AI companies on the block, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think AI is, to be quite honest, is being overhyped at the moment. I was in Dubai a couple of weeks ago and there was a guy who just made a speech there. I thought it was a pretty good speech, and he was standing on his own because when you're famous, people don't come up and talk to you. I'm not talking from personal experience, but his type of fame. And he's called Jensen Huang. He's the chief executive, founder, and principal shareholder of NVIDIA, which is So I went up and I spoke to him. And he was absolutely charming. He's Taiwanese by background, but American now.
Yeah. And did you get in that one early, by the way? Did you? Do you get the stock market wave on
No. I'm FOMO at the moment, like, you know, I probably just put all my money at the top. But the fact of the matter is they produce these things for $1,000, sell them for $30,000 to $50,000. Those sort of margins, particularly in semiconductors, can't be sustained. So they're just absolutely unsustainable. So there's a sort of bubble that's going on at the moment. Now, the other thing that I think we should address is that at the moment, data centers use 4% of
the emissions.
And 3 years' time, it's going to 12%.
Wow.
Right? And So this is something that needs to be thought about, because 4% you can kind of live with it. It's twice the level of aviation, for instance, but it's still a lot. But 12% gets up there with the worst polluting industries, doesn't it? So I really... Are you going to be at Master Investor on Saturday?
Yeah, I'm coming, yeah.
All right. There's a company there called... I just met them the other day, called Kudo or Kudo, something like that. And they're doing everything they can, the data center company, to mitigate the power usage in data centers around the world. It's a really interesting company. I'd go and talk to the guy.
Yeah, totally. Right.
And their run rate is just incredible. It's a very interesting company. And I was quite shocked by his figures about how much of global emissions will be produced by data centers. So there must surely be something around the corner. We don't know what it is. Otherwise, we would all be investing in it right now.
Yeah.
That's going to supplant the NVIDIA's, the current data center model and all that sort of stuff. I don't know what it is, but ingenuity in mankind is legion. And so I think we'll find that there will be something novel in the next 5 years that will upend all these models that say we're going to grow data center usage forever and ever and ever, because we're not.
Yeah, and I guess with the rise now of also quantum computing needing a load more power, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so Ilias Khan, Quantinuum, which is the world's biggest quantum computing company, so a merger with Honeywell's Quantum, is a very good friend of mine. He'll be speaking at Master Investor. And so definitely go and listen to his talk about it as well. He'll tell you all about where it's going, what it's at. They just raised, one of the most successful British companies, they just raised $300 million at a $5 billion money pre-valuation, which for a 13-year-old company is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's huge. So great, Jim. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I know we're a bit tight on time today, but yeah, just wanted to say thanks a lot, and let's continue to be in touch, and we'll hopefully get you back on and hear more of a progress, maybe perhaps towards the end of the year.
Well, I really appreciate it, Anna. You're a very good and nice interviewer, and very knowledgeable. And I look forward to seeing you on Saturday. And in the meantime, have a great rest of the week.
All right. Cheers. Thanks a lot, Jim. Bye. See you later. Bye. Take care. Bye.